I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Thursday afternoon, the 9th of July, David K. Johnston is our guest this hour. We have so much to discuss with him. We'll look at Greece. He can make sense out of very complicated stories. Greece is facing the unknown consequences of being pushed out of the Eurozone within the next week. The situation seems pretty dire in that country. We'll talk about the politics involved here and what would happen to the euro if Greece was not a member of the Eurozone anymore. David has done a very interesting study of a new report from the IRS. He says it's the latest proof that our income tax system is no longer progressive. Instead of tax burdens rising with income and thus with the ability to pay, the burdens fall off as incomes rise into the stratosphere. David says that doesn't make any sense. We'll be talking about President Obama. He was in La Crosse, as you know, last week and has spent some time talking about the proposed Labor Department rule that would make more workers eligible for overtime. We will be looking at that issue and many others with David. David is a distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University College of Law, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. He was with the New York Times for many years. He's the author of several books. He is editor of Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, and Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He's written other books as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, David. Thanks for being with us.
Well, delighted to be here, Catherine.
And you're my kind of guy because anybody who posts a picture on his Facebook, I went to your Facebook page of dancing elephants. Oh, I had to share it, David. It's a good one.
Yeah, no, that was a cute. A lot of bad animal videos, but that one was kind of cool.
Yeah, it was wonderful. They're smart creatures. Let's start with Greece, just because it's all over the news, and
sure.
you always make things understandable for all of us. What would be the consequences of their being pushed out of the Eurozone, and is Germany being too hard on Greece?
Well, the way to think about this is that the Greeks would not have the problems they have, but for two things. One is a terrible deal engineered by Goldman Sachs that made a lot of money for Goldman Sachs and doubled the Greek debt. And Robert Reich has an excellent explanation to this at his blog.
Mm.
And the other is that they don't control their own currency. The European Union is not a federal government like we have. And as a result, you end up with some serious problems connected with the euro. And so if they were to leave the euro and go back to having the drachma, there would be some awful short-term pain for the Greeks. But by adjusting the value of their currency, they would be able to work things out and go on their way. They will never recover, however, if they don't address a fundamental problem, one that is beginning to emerge in the United States, and that is they do not have an effective tax system.
Really?
Yeah, well, think about it this way. In the United States, this year, the federal income tax is about 8.5% of our economy. In Greece, tax evasion is 6% of their economy.
Hmm.
So you can get an idea of the magnitude of their difficulty that they don't have an effective and real tax system, and they don't enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's part of a trend that we are becoming moving towards in this country. If the Greeks leave the euro, there will be a lot of debt written off, which is going to be written off no matter what. It is not possible for the Greeks to pay back the amount of debt that they have. The World Bank or the International Monetary Fund put out a report in the last couple of days just before the election pointing this out. Bankers will have to take haircuts, which they're supposed to do. When you make a bad loan, then you don't get paid back. That's how you put discipline in banking. You only make loans that are sound. And the Germans, up until now, who dominate the European Union, have been willing to put up with a lot of stuff for a very simple reason. They have an export-based manufacturing economy, and the euro is underpriced relative to other currencies, which makes it easier to sell Mercedes-Benzes and computer systems and other forms of German engineering, that if Germany had to go back to the Deutsche Mark, wouldn't sell nearly so well.
I've been reading stories, as I'm sure you have, about what's going on with the average Greek person. It sounds like it could be just awful there very, very soon, that people can't get their medicines because that's coming in from an international market and their international transactions are on hold. People can't get enough money. They're going out and buying, those who have some money, as many purchases as they can. I'm sure they must be feeling some panic about what their futures are going to be. Will that be resolved for the average Greek person soon?
Well, eventually it will get resolved, but in the short run, there's going to be an enormous amount of economic pain. The Greek government will soon have to start paying employees and pensioners in scrip, in IOUs. And we have experience with this in the United States. State governments, when budgets weren't passed, have paid in scrip. And it becomes a form of currency. And so you go to the grocery store with, instead of your paycheck, with this scrip, and the grocer says, well, you know, it's not $100. I'll give you $90 worth of groceries. And the people who have some capital do fairly well at the end of the day if and when things get rolled through. But in the short term, there's going to be terrible pain in Greece over this.
Mm-hmm. And what about these austerity policies? What were those?
Well, the austerity policies, which have not worked anywhere, Paul Krugman has done a very good job of repeatedly pointing out that none of these work. I've written about it. Some other people have. The idea of the austerity policies is, you know, the problem with you Greeks is you're profligate. You're paying too much in pensions. You're spending too much on public education and other government services, and you need to cut all of that, and you need to raise taxes and give more money back to the bankers. Well, that certainly takes care of the bankers, but it doesn't encourage the bankers to be more prudent. It doesn't lead to any kind of reform. And as you reduce the liquidity in the economy, that is the amount of money flowing through that economy, it puts you in a vicious downward spiral instead of a growth spiral. And you know, Greeks have history with this. The great lawmaker Solon, you know, sometimes in newspapers we refer to lawmakers as Solons. He wiped out all debts. In the Old Testament, you had Jubilee, at least in theory, every 50 years where all debts were wiped out. The Icelanders, they wiped out all debts, and their economy has recovered fabulously. Now, they're a tiny country. They're 300,000 people, but they have like 5% unemployment. They went through a period of terrible pain, but they're back on track and doing just fine. And by the way, Greece isn't going to matter to you and me or the people listening to the show. The economy of Greece is roughly equal to the economy of Minneapolis-St. Paul. It is one-third of 1% of our trade in goods with Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It's tiny.
Mm-hmm. So why did our stock market go a bit haywire when this all started unraveling?
Because our stock market is not based now on investment, by which you put aside money today in an effort to earn profits in the future and grow your wealth. Our stock market is high-speed traders who are in and out of stocks in a fraction of a second in some cases, who are frothing the market so they can shave off a little bit of profit. And it's all heavily leveraged money. Hedge funds and high-speed trading are done with huge amounts of bank borrowing, so they're not inherently stable. In fact, I've shown a number of cases where private equity funds have negative investments. That's what Donald Trump always does. He buys something with all borrowed money, takes a fee off the top, and then he has a negative investment, and so any returns he gets are immeasurable. They're infinite. And that's what's going on Wall Street, and they're perfectly aware, the people who are in that business, that they are dealing with a house of cards created with current prices, created by government policies that enable people to use borrowed money to speculate in the markets, which is what brought the markets down in 1929.
Right. What a wacky world it is, right? And not very honorable.
Certainly not reflective of sound economic policies. And I think that's because, frankly, most Americans don't understand this stuff. If they did, they would be saying to their representatives, you fix this yesterday or we're all going to vote you out. We don't care. You know, we like you. We're voting you out unless you stop this.
Right. Well, let's talk about this other report that would make other people say, wait a second, what's going on here when we're in times of austerity? You looked at, along with researchers, more than 136 million tax returns. The top 0.01% paid just 17.6 cents of each dollar they earned in federal income taxes. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, if you're a single worker, no family, no children, and you make about $80,000, you'll pay more than that overall to the federal government. If you're a taxpayer who makes $250,000 a year, you'll pay a higher tax rate than that. And yet these people's average income was $161 million. And what's happening in our economy because of this reduction of tax rates at the top is back when we started the income tax 100 years ago, the notion was that we needed to tax what were then called surplus incomes. Adam Smith said that if you want to have a tax, you can't tax the basic income people need to live, what he called the necessaries of life. You tax abundant incomes above that. And the idea that the more income you have, the higher the tax you pay is 2,500 years old. It's what the Athenians came up with in combination with the invention of democracy. And at the top, these enormous incomes are coming to people because of globalization, technology, legal structures. They can't consume these incomes. You can't spend $161 million a year.
Right.
You could gamble it away, but you can't really consume it. And so you now have, with lower taxes, more and more and more money to reinvest, and you end up with concentrating money at the top and draining it from down below. It's just like a circulatory system where the blood's going out of the heart, but it's getting blocked somewhere and building up in your body and not getting passed on. Economics requires a circulatory system. So these enormous numbers at the top, 1,361 households, their tax burdens are falling over time. Their incomes are soaring. Of all the increased income in this country from 2009, that's when the recession officially ended, to 2012, 95 cents on the dollar went to the top 1%. But a third of that, it was really concentrated high up in the 1%, a third of that went to just 16,000 households.
Huh.
Think about the size of this country, 16,000
right.
households. I mean, if 16,000 households turned out at a big football game, we would say, wait a minute, why are there so many empty seats?
So what's the reasoning behind that? If you're talking about lean times and how we're recovering from this economic downturn, how can you lavish, as you write, so much tax relief on people who are making so much money that they don't know literally what to do with it?
Well, because if you were a member of Congress or I was a member of Congress, we would depend on a very narrow group of people to stay in office. And if you're a Republican and you don't toe the line on cutting taxes on people at the very top, they have a group called the Club for Growth. I have described it as, and will again right now, the equivalent of a mafia protection racket. You don't toe the line on cutting taxes for the richest Americans, we will put up money to run somebody against you and remove you from office. And they've been very successful. We've had good, solid conservative senators with real bona fides who've been removed in favor of these anti-tax radicals, who are agents of people who are very, very rich and don't want to pay taxes. And that's not everybody who's very rich. There are plenty of very wealthy people who understand that with their wealth and their income comes an obligation to support the society so it will endure. They may not like how government is spending the money or its choices, but they understand that fundamental role. But they're a minority of that group of people. So Congress writes laws that enable this. And if I can, my column today at Al Jazeera America is about how the private equity industry, which is entirely a creation of government policy, uses workers' pensions to acquire companies where they then kill pensions and unions and cut wages. I mean, the workers are having their own money used to damage themselves, and they don't know that.
No, they certainly don't know that. Well, what's going to change all of that? If you want to start businesses, if you want to get people employed in this country, it seems to me as though you have to free up some of that money. That's a huge amount of money that's going nowhere. A lot of houses, I guess. I don't know what else you do. How many boats can you buy with that money?
Well,
you could help people.
Right. We need to have a tax system and an economic system that flows from the economic order. Now, yesterday in New York, I rolled out for the first time something I've worked on for 20 years, but especially the last 3 years. And that is, I am drafting the legislation and a narrative book for an entirely new federal tax system I call the prosperity tax. And under the prosperity tax, most people wouldn't file a tax return. If you don't want to be, only unincorporated sole proprietors would file a tax return. There'd be no corporate income tax, but all corporate taxes, all corporate profits would be taxed. Companies would not be allowed, as Apple has done, to build up these incredible amounts of cash. Apple is holding, the last time I looked, about $150 billion of cash and near cash. That's money that could be productively invested or turned over to the shareholders so they could spend it in whatever way they see fit. It would require a much smaller IRS, and it's entirely based on existing law and existing principles. There's nothing new or radical in it. I just repurpose these to make sure that all gains are taxed except for that base of income that, as Adam Smith said, you need for the necessaries of life. And if we, and there'll be a book about this in about a year. I haven't quite finished the book yet. But we need to recognize that tax systems have to flow from the economic order. The Pharaoh in Egypt could not have run the government, which lasted 3,300 years, if it was based on the catch in the Nile. They had to tax instead the crops of wheat and emmer and cattle, just as the king in Hawaii could not have run the minimalist government that he had if it was based on the few crops that people grew on land. You've got to have a tax system that flows from the economic order. What we have now is a system that is throwing sand in the gears of commerce. It is encouraging financial speculation and discouraging, tremendously discouraging, meaningful investment in things that will create new wealth and in maintaining the public infrastructure that all of us can use to grow the economy, highways, bridges, internet, pipelines, all of those things.
But it also, reading between the lines of what you're saying here, David, would indicate that we would need a change in how we finance campaigns if a few people running for office are benefiting from that Club for Growth and holding the taxes where they are. You need a change in Citizens United, right?
Yes, absolutely, without a doubt. The efforts at campaign finance reform have had a perverse effect. And as somebody who wrote a lot about that in the 70s, I'm more than anybody aware of the perverse effect of this and look back at things I wrote in my 20s and sort of wish I had been a little wiser because sometimes well-intended reforms have awful consequences. But the campaign finance system is absolutely at the core of the problems that we have. And, you know, it reasonably does. If you were a senator, every day your staff would tell you, here are the meetings you have to have, here are these people, here are donors. And if your top donors don't believe that you're trying to get them what they want, even if you know they can't get it or even if you think it's not good for them, they're not going to continue to donate to you. And, you know, ask yourself, listening to this show, could you dial on the phone right now and get your congressperson or one of your two senators on the phone if you called? Could you get a five-minute meeting with them at their convenience in your district or state with them? On the other hand, I had sitting in the backyard of my home once in Rochester, New York, a number of very wealthy, prominent businessmen, and I made this observation, whereupon one of them pulled out his phone, flipped it open. This is when we had flip phones, pushed one button, and suddenly had our local congressperson on the phone.
Oh, speed dial, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I didn't even have her number.
Point well taken.
And her office number, not a cell number.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for David. David K. Johnston is our guest this hour. We started talking about Greece. If you have questions about that, he is writing a book right now. Interesting one. All his books are on prosperity tax. The IRS has done a study, and he's done a study of their study of the income taxes paid by the top 0.001%. In this country, and it's astonishing that we pay so much more in the middle class or even in the $250,000 range than people in the $161 billion range. They're not paying as much. So why is that? We're looking at that issue. We will talk more about the minimum wage. We'll talk about the president in the state of Wisconsin last week when he talked about overtime. We'll look at overtime. I want David to respond to the state Senate voting on an amendment in our state budget that partly repeals the requirement to pay the prevailing wage for local municipal projects. It does maintain the requirement for state projects. Is this something that's unusual? It pertains to Wisconsin, but not other states. Is prevailing wage used in other states? What does he think of that? And we welcome your phone calls in Citizens United. And there's even more we'll talk about. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. We're on Facebook as well. Or maybe we should post that dancing elephant video. Can we do that? To make you smile a little bit, because it's darling. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and he is a teacher. He writes for Al Jazeera. He wrote for the New York Times for many years, and he's the author of a number of books, Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, The Fine Print. He's the editor of the new anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number for you to join the conversation in this hour with David K. Johnston is 800-486-8655. Let's go to Brian in Grafton for our first call. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Kathleen. How you doing?
Fine, Brian. You?
Good.
Good. Good.
I have a question for Dave. He said that austerity measures do not work, and he rolled Paul Krugman into that also. But they have worked in Ireland. And I think he should set the record straight that they can work, and they do work.
David.
Well, I wouldn't disagree that there are, all of these are matters of facts and circumstances. And in Ireland, where they build an economy largely on finance, particularly setting up a lease business and favorable tax advantages for companies that had little to no presence in Ireland, austerity turned out to be a useful thing. So you're right. I said that too bluntly. But in the case of Greece, austerity is not the solution to their problem. Their problem is that things are so austere, they are in a downward spiral, and they cannot possibly pay back the level of debt they had. And remember, the debt they had doubled because of a deal they made with Goldman Sachs. And they've done this all over the country. You know, states that have seen their pension bills double because of these derivatives deals that Goldman sold that made a lot of money for Goldman traders.
Thank you very much, Brian, for your call. I want to talk about a couple visits in the state of Wisconsin. Bernie Sanders was here. 10,000 people in Madison showed up to see him. President Obama was in La Crosse last week. Let's start with Bernie Sanders, David. What is his economic message that seems to be so popular among people who consider themselves progressive? He's drawing really large crowds, even though he's being somewhat dismissed by members of the press.
Well, he's certainly being you know, damned with faint praise in the press.
Mm-hmm.
The things that Bernie Sanders has on his economic agenda are very popular with the public. They poll at between, depending on which issue it is, about 70 and over 90%. Gallup has been doing polls on should the wealthiest Americans, the highest income Americans, pay higher taxes, and the numbers on that, the general trend line is up and up and up. More and more people say, yes, they're not paying enough taxes. Well, that's one of his big things that he's calling for. Bernie believes in unions, and as you've heard me say on the show before, Kathleen, if you believe in market economics, then you believe in unions, because only when you have people collectively bargaining with their employers do you have a labor market. Otherwise, you just have a dictation by the employers of what they will pay. He wants to strengthen Social Security. Well, 3 out of 4 Republicans in polls want to increase Social Security benefits, and almost 7 out of 10 Republicans are willing to pay higher taxes to do that. He wants to have higher income workers paying Social Security. Right now we cut it off at about $117,000. If we just went back to Ronald Reagan's policy of taxing 90% of Social Security, Social Security would be sound forever, but we're down to about 83% and falling. Sanders would actually expand and go beyond that, but that's very popular. He, of course, would like to replace the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, with national health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And our mess of an insurance system is a huge drain on our economy. We're spending more than twice the average of other modern industrial countries, and it means we don't have money to invest in other things that we need. So the things that he wants are very popular with a significant portion of the public. I don't know whether he's electable or not, but contrast his declaration of where he stands with Hillary Clinton's efforts to not respond, not talk, stay away, because she assumes that she's going to get the nomination and therefore doesn't want to stumble.
Mm. And doesn't want to create bad feelings with people in Wall Street, on Wall Street, who may be close allies and funding sources for her?
Yes, and of course, Bill Clinton signed many of the laws that have done the most economic damage in the United States. I mean, it was Herman Cain, you recall Herman Cain from the presidential election.
Yes, I do.
It was Herman Cain who persuaded Bill Clinton to agree to sign a law that forever, regardless of inflation, fixes the wage of restaurant workers at $2.13 an hour plus tips. Well, it's been 20 years now, and there's been a lot of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Mrs. Clinton has been very close to Wall Street. I don't think she will be where her husband was, but without any doubt, she is a candidate who is acceptable to Wall Street.
Let's go to Ron in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Kathleen, and hello, David. I just wanted to join the conversation, and then I'll jump off. I'm en route to the airport, but I was listening before to David's comment about the Greek crisis, and I think the thing that I find troubling, by context, I want to let you know I worked in the Middle East and Africa and was based in Cyprus in the 90s. We did a lot of business with Greece during that period, and I can tell you up front, the worst-kept secret in that country for probably the last 30 years is that most of those citizens do not declare all of their income. And
right.
The black market economy or gray market, whatever you want to call it, represented roughly 40% even at that time. And so the fact that they now have a crisis because most of their citizens shield their income and that there is no accountability for that is one of the things that I find interesting that David didn't comment on. Because he seemed to blame the bankers without holding the Greeks themselves.
Actually, Ron, I said exactly that. I said that Greece doesn't have a real tax system, and that's a fundamental problem. There's an enormous amount of evasion, and I gave specific figures. In the United States, our federal income tax is about 8.5% of our economy. In Greece, tax evasion is 6% of their economy. And that is the amount of taxes they would pay, but for evasion would be 6 percentage points of their GDP. And clearly the Greeks do not have a real tax system, and that is a fundamental problem. It will hold them back forever. They've got to fix this, and no question about it. But the bankers made loans knowing they don't have a real tax system.
Thanks very much for your call, Ron. Could we talk about prevailing wage? It's been a big issue in the state of Wisconsin. It's in the budget now, which the governor will be signing before he goes to a lot of places running for president. It is repealing the requirement to pay a prevailing wage for local and municipal projects. It will maintain that requirement for state projects. Is this peculiar to the state of Wisconsin, a prevailing wage? And what do you think of prevailing wages, David?
Okay. The idea of the prevailing wage, which is in federal law and every state, at least north of the Mason-Dixon line, is that government should pay people real wages. And there's a federal law called the Davis-Bacon Act, for example, that requires this. And it results in workers on federal highway projects being well paid. When you get rid of the prevailing wage, what you're doing is putting pressure to lower wages. You're making it easier for all employers to pay less. And as Adam Smith taught, all employers at all times are engaged in a conspiracy to lower wages, but you don't hear about it because they know how to keep quiet about it, whereas whenever workers try to get higher wages, you immediately hear about it. The prevailing wage goes with the effort to get rid of unions. There is a clear campaign to lower wages. In fact, the Koch brothers, in a memo to their employees one year, actually way down buried in it, made the argument that lower wages were good for you, the workers. That's an astonishing argument. This is part of the effort by Wisconsin Republicans to vitiate unions. And when we had in the 70s about 37% of private sector workers in unions, about 80% of workers benefited from it. If you worked at the Rambler factory in Kenosha, the American Motors factory in Kenosha, and you were a first, second, third level supervisor, your wage is really set by the United Auto Workers. If they didn't get a raise, you didn't get much of a raise. And we need to recognize that what the prevailing wage is, and we can make reasonable arguments about what's the appropriate prevailing wage, but when you repeal prevailing wage laws, you are causing all workers within a market to have a more difficult time getting a raise or even maintaining the pay they have. And we can see this in the data. The bottom 90% of Americans' tax returns show that when you adjust for inflation, their income has fallen back to below the level of 1967.
Ooh.
That since 2000, the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans has fallen from about $35,000 a year to $30,000 a year. That's $100 a week less income adjusted for inflation. The median wage, half of Americans make more, half make less, has been essentially stuck at a little over $500 a week since 1998. And the last fall, I did a column in Al Jazeera America about the 60 categories of pay that the government tracks through W-2 wage statements. They add them up to the penny. There are 59 categories. The top category is 50 million and above. 60 categories. The 59 categories below $50 million, wages went down. The only increase was in people whose average wage is $50 million a year or more, and there's only about 100 of those. But that was the only increase, was in that group.
And
there's something seriously wrong here.
Well, and those people, as we said before, aren't spending a whole lot of money. They have spent, you know, you don't need all that much money. So how can you grow an economy if people have less money to spend? I don't quite understand.
You can't. I mean, you simply can't. You will be worse off over time. And, you know, how we as a society divide the production of our society is a very important issue. We were much more prosperous when we had better paid workers, because better paid workers, all those workers and all those different making choices, I'm going to buy a Rambler, you're going to buy a Pinto, somebody else is going to buy a Volkswagen, we're going to save our money, we're going to put in a swimming pool, we're going to send our kids off to summer camp, whatever it is you decided to do, that creates jobs for the people. But when you don't have enough money, then those jobs go away, and then you throw in, we doubled the world's force of labor through our trade agreements with China and elsewhere. And while overall trade should be a good thing in the long run, in the short run, it's been devastating to this country. We've lost 2.8 million manufacturing jobs. And I haven't looked at the data, but I would guess in Wisconsin, the total number of jobs. How many people live in Wisconsin?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? 3 million? I don't know. I should know.
Well, all right. So it's probably more than every job in Wisconsin then. Because not everybody works. It's equal to all the jobs in greater Philadelphia, including Wilmington, Delaware, and Atlantic City. And that's just to China and just in manufacturing. The trade agreement President Obama signed with South Korea, he said it'll result in more trade on both sides. Well, it has. It has. I've looked at the numbers every month, and it has. And for every dollar of additional trade we have going to South Korea, $25 is going the other direction. That's not a good economy for us, where it's 25 to them and one to us.
And it's 5.8 million in Wisconsin. I was way off.
5.8 million people. Well, then basically it's every job in Wisconsin, because there'd be fewer than 2.8 million jobs. We are not pursuing. What's the point of having a democratic society if it isn't there to promote the general welfare, which is what our Constitution says is one of its six noble purposes, to promote the general welfare? You know, Franklin Roosevelt taught you don't measure a society by how much richer you make the rich. You measure it by how much you alleviate people at the bottom. Mm. And the best way to alleviate people at the bottom is to have employment programs for those who can work, and for those who can't work, then a decent system of support.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What you're saying seems like a radical idea. And when you look, we spent an hour with Gary Hart a couple days ago, in which he was talking about the founding fathers and what their idea was for a commonwealth and the common good and the public interest, et cetera. You just don't seem to see politicians governing with that in mind or the country thinking about that these days. What's good for everybody? What's the best thing for everybody?
And they're not thinking about it because the people who they have to listen to and are approached by lobbyists every day mm-hmm. represent very wealthy people, right. So their minds are focused. I mean, just like, you know, when you fell in love, were you thinking about, you know, some other guy, Kathleen, or you thinking about the guy you were in love with, right? It focuses your mind, and the campaign finance system focuses these minds. The founders wrote extensively about their concern that what would destroy our country ultimately and would be extreme inequality and people not owning their own land and owning their own tools. And maybe it's not practical to own your own tools, but you certainly could own a shares of companies. So to make our society prosper, we need to have a system that is progressive in its taxation so that the people who have done the best because they live in this country contribute the most to the country enduring, that we have a system that allows workers to negotiate for reasonable wages. All of our competitors have unions, and they're doing fine. They're not creating as many jobs as we are. That is absolutely true. But they don't have the poverty and the pathologies that we have. We need to create certainty in people's lives so they can plan. You know, we shouldn't have a system where newspapers repeatedly are running stories the last few years. People who played by the rules, went to school, whether it was to become a machinist or an accountant, saved their money, behaved prudently, and then got wiped out and totally wiped out by the changes in the economy. And we've left in charge the people who did this. I mean, who leaves in charge of a bank an embezzler? And we have people who embezzled the economy, basically, and committed crimes that we're not prosecuting them for.
Yeah.
By the way, one of the simplest things we could do was proposed by Glenn Hubbard, who is the head of the business school at Columbia University and was George Bush's Council of Economic Advisors president, and mm-hmm. Professor Chris Mayer. They said that the when we were bailing out the banks, they said every mortgage should be turned over to the Fed. The Fed should acquire every mortgage, and you no fees to you or anything else. They just pay off the mortgage holders, and then you get your rate lowered on your mortgage for whatever the remaining balance of it is. That's what they did something even more extreme than that in Iceland. They just wiped out the mortgages. But if we did that, if everybody suddenly had a 2.5% or 3% mortgage, yeah, there's some inequity in it. It's not perfect. There's rough justice there. But it would free up an enormous amount of money. It would allow people to spend it on things like fixing up the houses they can't afford to fix up. And it would stimulate economic activity through the society. We've got to be thinking long-term about wealth creation, encouraging investment that creates jobs, not investment that speculates in financial products.
David K. Johnston is our guest this hour. He joins us fairly often on this program. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. We spoke a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We'll talk more about that. We're talking about Greece and inequality and income taxes paid or very not as much paid by the very, very way up in the stratosphere, highest income people in this country, prevailing wage, what's happened with unions. He teaches business, tax, and property law at Syracuse University. He's the author of several books, including the new anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Our phone number, a couple lines are open for you right now, is 800-486-8655. Feel free to call the number and join our conversation. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we'll return to you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston with us this hour, and we go next to Eric in Green Bay. Hi, Eric.
Hi, I have just a quick question. Why do they always say that, like, the top 1% of the population of America, the richest, whatever, pay 99%? I don't know the exact stats, but it's always, you know, they pay the top, all the taxes, or a greater percentage of the taxes.
Well, okay, good question. First of all, the top 1% pay around 30, depending on the year, 35 to 40% of the federal income tax. That's only one-fifth of all the taxes in the country. And that's because that's what an income tax is. It's designed to tax the largest incomes at the highest rates. And the moral principle of that is 2,500 years old. It's been endorsed by every classic worldly philosopher through history, even John Locke, although in very mild, mild form. Now, when you look at, and by the way, that top group is has the largest share of U.S. income they've ever had. They're now at around 22%. So more than $1.05 of income for the whole country goes to the 1%. And most of that goes to the top end of the 1%. Half of the 1% are make between $400,000 and $600,000. That could be two doctors married to each other in that group. It's the people way up who pay very little in tax. When you look at all taxes, the whole system, all federal taxes, Social Security, Medicare, excise taxes, gasoline taxes, and then state and local taxes, it's actually much closer to a flat tax. And if you just look at state and local taxes, every state but one, including the states of Wisconsin and Minnesota, the poorest people pay significantly higher state and local taxes than the richest. In a number of states, the top 1% pay half what the bottom 20% pay. And the reason you hear these numbers, and you know, 99% of tax, I've actually heard that on the radio, is because we have created a society where we worship people based not on the content of their character or their accomplishments, but on the size of their wallet, or in the case, I guess, of Donald Trump, the presumed size of their wallet.
Thank you, Eric, for your call. Gina in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for doing this program. I guess what I just wanted to say is my husband is a public school teacher in Wisconsin. He's master educated, and I'm a registered nurse, and life is hard. I mean, can't afford to send our kids to college, having to take lots of student loans out, things like that. And, you know, at some point, where is our break? We keep saying, you know, they keep saying we're cutting taxes, but they're nickel and diming you with every single thing. And, you know, now I thought, well, at least my husband's going to have a good pension maybe when he retires, and now you have to worry about the pension system in Wisconsin, too. It's just, it's every day, and it's so frustrating, and it's just, you just feel like maybe we should just, you know, maybe we shouldn't have tried to better ourselves in our,
well,
in the world.
Gina, do not give up on this. The whole idea of the United States is that we will solve our own problems. We got rid of slavery. We got child labor laws. We had at one time very good union laws, though they're being vitiated right now. We have environmental laws. The whole idea of our country is we can solve our own problems. The only way that happens, though, is when people become actively involved. And I've repeatedly said, you know, if you're not happy with the fact that the Reagan era, 35 years in, has led to lower incomes for the vast majority of Americans, well, I'm sorry, did you vote for other people? Did you get out and organize? Did you turn people out at the polls? You know, and ultimately, at the end of the day, we're to blame for whatever our circumstances is.
Your statement is an important one, though. Wouldn't you agree, David, when she talked about their occupations, a public school teacher and a registered nurse, those should be solid middle-class jobs, middle-class
income. Absolutely. And if you don't want to pay for well-educated, smart people to be public school teachers, then don't expect your children and grandchildren to be well-educated. You know, this idea that teachers, you know, oh, they only work, you know, 6 hours a day, right, 9 months a year. Nonsense. What a crazy bit of nonsense. I have a college education because college was free when I grew up in California, and I had to go to work full-time when I was 13 years old to help the family, and because I qualified as a war orphan under the GI Bill. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a college education. The taxpayers invested in me, and they have made a tremendous amount of money off of my success.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you very much for your call, Gina. And you, when you talk about what it is that needs to be done, you did write, you know, an optimistic kind of column, Egalitarianism is on the March, fairly recently, David.
Yes. Well, I think that we're beginning to see a shift. I mean, I actually thought it started around 2006, and it was a sort of a last hurrah of Reaganism in the 2014 elections. But the column was teed off of the Confederate battle flag, which I pointed out is the symbol of traitors and racists who were not hung, whose ancestors were not hung after the war in 1865. And imagine if these people were saying, well, it's part of our heritage to fly the Nazi flag or the hammer and sickle. you know, they wouldn't be regarded at all the way they have been up until now. And we're seeing in a number of court decisions, the Supreme Court on equal marriage for same-sex and different-sex couples, the Affordable Care Act, that there is a shift going on in this country. It's beginning to happen, but it's going to take a lot of work. And it can't continue the way it is. The polls show that the public has moved. Now, if people will go to the polls, we'll begin to see change. But it changes take time. You know, we spent 35 years digging ourselves into this hole, and we're not going to dig out of it in 2 or 3 years. It's going to take a long time and a lot of hard work, and people need to learn, act, register to vote, go to the polls, and get other people to the polls. If everybody in this country voted, in Australia they have mandatory voting. If everybody voted, we'd have a very different Congress.
Yes, we would. Gina, thanks. Sinead in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi. One consequence of not having unions is that people can be fired without cause. So you do not have any job stability. How do people dare buy a house and commit to a 30-year mortgage if their job is not going to be there because somebody's nephew wants the job or because they're on a whim, it's decided to just throw your job away and you can't be there anymore.
And Sonata, here's another part of that.
You have to be able to count on being able to pay a mortgage or you are not going to buy a house.
Right. Well, Sonata, in addition to that, what banker in their right mind, if they had to hold the mortgage, they couldn't sell it to a public employee pension fund like they do, if they had to hold the mortgage in the portfolio of the bank, would issue a mortgage to people whose jobs are unstable? The fact is that labor income is about 86% of all the income in this country, either salaries and wages or pensions or deferred income from work. That's almost all the money in this country. And if we take away all worker rights, then why would a bank loan you money for 3 years or even five to buy a car because of instability? We need to have stable incomes for people, and we need to create rules that recognize that all rights do not belong to the owners of businesses. They have a lot of rights, but so do workers, so do taxpayers, so does the community. We need to go back to this idea of commonwealth that you said Gary Hart was talking about on the show a couple days ago, which the founders were very, very strong on.
Yes, they were. Sinead, thank you. Tom in Madison, hi.
Hi. My comment is just the frustration of who do we actually vote for, though? You know, we've had, you've mentioned it yourself, that Clinton had some of the worst policies put into place, you know, in the last 20 years. Reagan's been bad, Bush not great, but Obama had a Democrat Senate for a while, I believe, and not a lot went the right direction. We've actually gone the wrong direction under Obama. And honestly, I'm, you know, very much a Bernie Sanders supporter myself, but Hillary Clinton, if she does get in, I don't trust that for anything. Like, who do we actually vote for? Because it seems like whether it's Republican or Democrat, typically the same direction is continuing to happen.
Right. Well, a couple of things. First of all, the economy's done tremendously well under Obama, and he doesn't get credit for it. The stock market has, you know, more than doubled. We've created 60-plus months of jobs growth, private sector job growth in a row, which is unprecedented in American history. But wages haven't gone up. You do this by a couple of things. FDR once said, when someone said, "Do this, Mr. President," he said, "Well, no, you have to make me do it." If Hillary Clinton becomes president, she will go where she realizes the public demands they go. Pay attention to who you elect to state representative and state senator. They're the ones who draw the lines for legislative districts and set things like education budgets. So you need to get out, find people who will run for these offices, knock on doors. Don't spend the money on TV ads. That is an incredibly stupid way to spend the money. Knock on doors and get people to register to vote and take them to the polls. Make sure they literally go to the polls to vote. That's how you make change, and it starts from the bottom up. You know, the civil rights movement started after World War II, and all these black soldiers came home and said, "We're not going to put up with this anymore." And you had simple acts. Rosa Parks refusing to get off the back of the bus. A planned event. It didn't just spontaneously happen. It was a calculated event. But it led to these changes, and we can get these changes, but people have to work at them.
David K. Johnson, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. David K. Johnston, currently working, we didn't know this, but now we do a new book, Prosperity Tax, which I'm sure will be interesting. David has written a number of books. His new anthology is Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News is coming up, NPR, and we'll return for another hour. Stay with us.